Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Black Pain, It Just Looks Like We're Not Hurting by Terry M. Williams, narrated by Madeline McCrae. This publication contains the opinions and ideas of its author and other third parties. It is sold with the understanding that neither the author nor the publisher is engaged in rendering medical, health, psychological, or any other kind of personal professional services in the book. If the listener requires personal, medical, health, or other assistance or advice, a competent professional should be consulted. The author and publisher specifically disclaim all responsibility for any liability, loss, or risk, personal or otherwise, that is incurred as a consequence, directly or indirectly, of the use and application of any of the contents of this book. This is a work of nonfiction. However, certain names and details have been changed, some characters are composites, and some dialogue has been edited. Depression is rage turned inward. We wear the mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile, and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but oh, great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet, and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask. Paul Laurence Dunbar. Foreword by Mary J. Blige. Everywhere I go, I'm moved by painful stories my people share with me. I look into their faces and I see myself reflected in their eyes. I feel their longing for comfort and their need for peace of mind. Women speak about how they are abused by men they love and the shame that comes with allowing it to happen again and again. I can relate, because I've walked in their shoes. I know the brother's pain, too. I know that we're all bleeding internally, trying to patch up our own wounds with bandages, when we need healing from head to toe. We need to love ourselves. And we can't love ourselves until we let God into our lives to help us heal and find our purpose. We find our strength, our truth through God's love. Sometimes, facing our truth is the hardest thing to do because it means reaching out and asking for help. It means having the courage to tell your truth so that others can be healed. That's the way I try to live my life. Even though it's not always easy, we have to make sacrifices because we are responsible for one another. Terry Williams knows this too. As a woman in business, she put her career on the line by going public about her depression. I believe her when she says that she is a woman on fire. I know it's true when she says Black people are hiding their pain and dying every day because of it. I believe that Terry is a woman who loves God as I do, and that he is using her to do his work. As African American women, we share a common bond by acknowledging that we know depression up close. We've never had a book this personal that defines our feelings and helps us understand what to do to heal ourselves. I'm proud of Terry for writing Black Pain, so that everyone will finally recognize depression. As she puts it, what it looks, sounds, and feels like. And I'm proud of all the people in the book who had the courage to share their stories with the rest of us. Foreword by Susan L. Taylor. In the June 2006 issue of Essence magazine, my beloved friend Terry M. Williams bravely bared her soul by revealing her battle with debilitating bouts of depression for over half her life. The moment that issue hit the stands, a tidal wave of responses began pouring into the Essence offices. In an overwhelming reaction, thousands of men and women were moved to write to us, not only to express their admiration of Terry's courage, but to break their silence and admit that they, too, are struggling with similar issues in their lives. Terry's remarkable piece sounded the alarm, awakening our consciousness of Black America's deep secret. Even now, people are still talking, and the letters keep coming in, all reaching out to her. Terry has heard you, feels your pain, and this book is her way of reaching back to you. You are holding in your hands a true blessing. Black Pain was written with love straight from the center of Terry's heart because she loves us so and knows that too many of us are silently suffering. She has thrown her net far and deep to bring together all of the information, resources, and inspiration she could muster to let us know that we can be better, that we can live healthier, happier lives. That is who she is and what she does naturally. Black Pain invites you to share in the raw, honest stories of other brave souls willing to speak about their emotional struggles. You will hear about the well-known, the everyday people, the health professionals, and Terry herself, who finally put into words the sadness so many of us are suffering, yet never knew how or never had the courage to describe. But what are we going to do about the emotional pain so many of us are hosting and holding on to? Too often we work overtime, hiding it behind a mask that makes us appear to be powerful, in control, and confident. The reality is that, privately, in the silence of our souls, we are dying because we simply don't know how to reach out for help. We barely exist, limping through each day under the weight of anxiety buried so deep and suffering so acute. It's made us lethargic, unable to cope with our angst. We hide our anxiety even from family and friends because we fear being judged as weak and ineffective. In doing this, we're allowing and nurturing a state of emergency in the Black community, a state that twists the lives of those who need us most, our poor and our vulnerable young. This is not who we are as a people. Since the beginning of time and throughout our history, we have come through the fire and brought with us a powerful testimony of strength, creativity, and miracles that we seem to have reached up and pulled right out of the heavens. Yet, at a time when we should be soaring, we're floundering. And I know that because of this, we won't do the larger critical work God is calling us to do, attend to the pain and suffering all around caused by lack in the land of plenty. Our people will remain shackled in the bondage of misery, unable to move forward until you and I free and heal ourselves. This is possible only if we come out of hiding, if we will be as brave as Terry and tell the truth. Our coming into the light needn't be a public declaration like Terry's. It just needs to happen in our psyches and our souls. And we must commit to receiving the gift of therapy, which will help heal us. Terry has opened the way. We just have to walk it. We have to admit that we bear the generational wounds caused by hundreds of years of slavery and abuse, the separation from family and culture, and all that was dear and familiar to us. The heinous acts of violence are not forgotten. We remember that our beauty and our humanity were degraded, defiled, and devalued. The wonder is not that so many black folks have succumbed. The wonder is us, that we have survived. We are the offspring of the people who refuse to die. But all is not well, and we don't have much time to secure our future as a people. We are in a deep crisis. In order for us to carry on in whole health and wellness, each of us, in his and her own way, must fess up to our weaknesses and lift one another up in collective support. We have to ask what work we are required to do to shine, and then get it done. Picking up this book is a glorious first step. Black pain points the way to healing, teaches us that our hurting has a name, and shows us that we are not alone in our darkness. Along with Terry, I encourage you to continue the journey toward inner peace. Your harvest awaits. Let the healing begin. Introduction. Black Blues. I am a woman on fire. I have two favorite pictures of myself as a little girl. One is of me at age 3, naked except for my panties, standing on a large pillow with a huge smile and my arms flung out wide. The other is of me about a year later dressed as Queen Esther from the Bible for a nursery school play. For the past year, almost 50 years later, I am more like the child in those pictures than I have ever been. For much of my career, I have spoken to diverse groups of thousands of people around the country about achieving success in business and in the field of public relations. In the last 2 years, I've begun dealing with major depression in my life. And when I give talks now, they're less about business than they are about this misunderstood disease. First, I talk about how depression almost killed me. In other words, I stand in front of audiences of hundreds of people, naked and transparent, with my arms flung open. Then I talk about depression and black people, how it is crushing our youth and destroying our lives, those who suffer from depression along with those who care about them. It is then that I think of Queen Esther, because she was called upon to reveal herself to save the lives of her people. And she was scared to do it. But she couldn't stand to watch her people be destroyed. She had to save them. I think of Queen Esther because depression is killing black people by the thousands. And I have to talk about it, no matter how much it scares me. When I cast my eyes over the sweep of my life up to now, I see my whole adulthood in the long shadow of depression. The shadow starts right on the brink of my grown-up life. I was studying at Columbia University to become a clinical social worker. I work like a maniac, doing everything required, everything optional, and even more work that I assigned to myself. The rest of the time, I slept. At first, I didn't notice the change. Then things got worse. I always hated waking up, but slowly it was turning into something deeper. It was less like I didn't want to wake up, and more like I couldn't. I didn't feel tired, but I had no energy. I didn't feel sleepy, but I would have welcomed sleep with open arms. I had the sensation of a huge weight, invisible but gigantic, pressing down on me, almost crushing me into the bed and pinning me there. The next second, my heart would start pounding like crazy, and I would jerk myself upright and throw off the weight, heaving breath until the panic faded. and then I would get up and do what I had to do. I woke up with this terror every day. It felt like the universe was closing in on me. On top of that, I started isolating myself. Whenever I turned down an invitation to do anything and got past the point where the person pressed me with, "Are you sure?" and finally accepted my no, I felt only one thing: relief. And the panic got worse. By the end of my first semester, I decided to see a therapist. I found a nice and well-intentioned white guy. Every week for 9 months, we talked, mainly about schoolwork and my daily routine, because I never once felt safe to talk about what was really bothering me: my obsessive working, my constant sleeping, and my chronic fear. Deep down, I think I couldn't shake messages from my childhood like, "Keep your feelings to yourself," and "Don't air your dirty laundry, especially in front of white folks." In the end, my therapist described me as guarded, but on top of things. And I'm sorry to say that his shallow reading of my symptoms satisfied me. I didn't know at the time that misdiagnosing depression in Black patients is routine, that our strong personal style, on top of beliefs that we can handle anything, often makes white professionals miss how much pain or anguish we're in. I was no exception. My therapist had misdiagnosed me by a long shot. After a while, my symptoms lessened, and I began work as a clinical social worker. The change, coupled with focusing on problems other than my own, started to make me feel more like my old self again. I still didn't understand the feelings I'd had in graduate school, but since that was behind me, I told myself, so were those feelings. I thought I was back on top of things, but you know the saying, denial isn't a river in Egypt. After 2 years of social work, I felt drained. God must have had a hand in leading me on a new path, because within a year I had changed careers completely. Working at breakneck pace, I became a public relations counselor, landing A-list celebrities like Miles Davis and Eddie Murphy. On the outside, I was living the American dream. But on the inside, things still didn't feel right. By the year 2000, I was the head of a public relations and marketing firm that was growing beyond my wildest hopes. But once again, every day I was waking up with crippling anxiety. Once I was out the door, I was on. By 9 a.m., I had typically read 5 papers, placed 20 calls, and spoken with over a dozen people. My office was buzzing. Clients were calling, news was breaking. I was doing promotion, like getting a celebrity on a magazine cover or getting the word out about a new CD or a movie or a book. And damage control, helping a client do media interviews after a DUI. And by 6 p.m., I was gearing up for that evening's movie premiere, fundraiser, or book party. It was rare that I got home before midnight. When I did, there was nothing left. Nothing left for me. Here I had everything society tells us should make us happy: success, money, access, but not one thing in my life gave me pleasure. In the middle of all this action and all these people, I felt like I was in solitary confinement. And I began to cope with these feelings of emptiness and dread by numbing the pain with food. The only thing I look forward to after a 16-hour day. On the way home, I would pick up snack foods: ice cream, party mix, cheese, mix them with leftovers from restaurant dinners, and eat until I was beyond full. But my hunger increased week by week until every half hour I would get out of bed and go to the refrigerator for a snack. I was gaining weight. The more weight I gained, the more disgust I felt. The more self-disgust I felt, the more I wanted to hide from the pain by eating and sleeping. Like every drug, the food gave me less relief each day, but I clung to it. It was the only thing in my life that could soothe me, the only crutch I had to help me limp around my intolerable feelings. But what started as a source of comfort became another prison. The saddest thing about all this is that I was able to go so long without anyone really noticing or at least feeling like they could say something. Every shred of energy I could muster after a night of sleep interrupted by binge eating went into servicing my clients and doing my superwoman act, competent, together, a single woman making it on willpower alone. I was the poster girl for ambition and achievement, the strong black woman. Strangely, sadly, the facade held up. As far as my colleagues and clients were concerned, the work got done and got done well. Sometimes I think about how things might have gone if I had been a less talented actress, less able to convince everyone around me of something I knew was false. The bottom line was that my success, the thing I had given so much of myself to, was a cover for what was killing me. I had reduced myself to two modes, my game face, the soul-destroying mask I wore to work, and the numbed-out shell of a woman who sat alone in her apartment, eating and sleeping. Finally, I reached the breaking point. I woke up one morning with a knot of fear in my stomach so crippling that I couldn't face light, much less day, and so intense that I stayed in bed for 3 days with the shades drawn and the lights out. 3 days. 3 days not answering the phone. 3 days not checking my email. I was disconnected completely from the outside world, and I didn't care. Then, on the morning of the fourth day, there was a knock on my door. Since I hadn't ordered food, I ignored it. The knocking kept up, and I kept ignoring it. I heard the sound of keys rattling in my front door. Slowly, the bedroom door opened, and in the painful light from the doorway, I saw the figures of two old friends. "Terry, are you in there?" They opened the windows, and I shielded my eyes against the light. They sat down and put their hands on me, gently lifting me to sit up. I don't think I could have done it myself. They stayed for 3 hours. They did the dishes, got me into the shower, helped me pick out clothes, made me an emergency appointment with a therapist that afternoon, and somehow got me there. I honestly don't remember how. 15 minutes into the session, I was staring at the therapist, barely understanding our conversation, and feeling like I'd fall down on the floor any second when she said the words, "clinical depression." I felt like I was outside my body, like I was seeing us on TV, but I knew something had finally given. I couldn't go on the way I was without hurting myself more. The therapist told me I was in an emotionally dangerous place, that I would probably need medication before any real work could begin. She gave me the name of a psychiatrist and called to make the first appointment for the next day herself. She gave me her cell phone number, telling me to call if I didn't think I could make it to tomorrow. I looked at her and the number. Tomorrow? Tomorrow was a million years from now. I wasn't going to make it to the next hour. Forget about tomorrow. My friends took me home. One of them stayed the night. Somehow, I did make it to the next day and to my appointment with the psychiatrist. She asked questions, took my blood pressure, and began the long process of finding the right medication for me. Those 6 months were some of the hardest of my life. After 2 weeks, the medication kicked in a little, and I felt slightly better. And with it came an overwhelming clarity about what my life had become, a clarity that brought me a new kind of despair. I was in a pit so deep I didn't know if I could get out, and even though I was functioning, I was probably in a more fragile state than when I lay in bed unable to move. I was so low I couldn't fall off the floor. When I think back on that time, I'm stunned. There I was, a mental health professional. And I couldn't bring myself to admit that I was suffering from a major clinical depression. I had been too paralyzed by my feelings to recognize the whole range of symptoms. All my energy was going into just functioning, doing the work things I had to do. And because I was hiding my feelings, the only guide to my well-being became my own confused perceptions. Then I had a thought that began to change my life. If this could happen to me, with all my experience and knowledge and access, what was happening to other people? What was happening to people who didn't have any of my resources? That was when I realized that the only way I was going to get through this was to stop pretending, finally, that it wasn't happening. And the only way to stop pretending was to let people know how I felt every day. The first time I did it, God told me to. I heard His voice telling me it was time to share my story, and I obeyed. I used to wonder when people would say, "God spoke to me." But now I know. It was just 4 months after my meltdown when I was scheduled to give a talk at a conference with a good number of the best-known people in the world of business. I kept wanting to cancel the talk, telling myself again and again that it was too early, that I wasn't ready, and that, honestly, I might never be. But for reasons I couldn't understand, I didn't cancel, and I forced myself to go. As I walked up to the podium, my fear was so intense that I thought I was going to vomit. I made myself breathe deep and kept reminding myself that there's no way out but through. I knew that God put me there for a reason. Then I did something that shocked everyone in the room, including me. I told the truth. Instead of the high-powered, upbeat talk about self-marketing that we were all expecting, I told the audience straight out that I suffered from depression, that I was standing in front of them on sheer willpower, and that I was afraid that willpower would fail me at any moment. As I spoke, I heard a voice inside me say, "Career suicide." To my surprise, I was relieved by the thought. If telling the truth was career suicide, then the sham I had been living for so long was about to end. But instead, something amazing happened. The powerful men and women gathered to talk about business and do business seemed to be empathizing with me. I barely remember the talk, but I vividly remember that after it, many people in the audience, men and women alike, came over and told me how moved they were by my courage and confession. They admitted to similar bouts of despair, how helpless and afraid they were, and how ashamed they were to have those feelings. After that day, I began to discover that telling the truth is addictive. Every time I did it, and survived, I wanted to do it again. The more I took off my mask, the more I shared my story, the more folks shared back with me. Slowly, the clinical social worker woke up. It's a given that depression is all over the media, at least as a buzzword. You can hardly turn on the TV without seeing a commercial for an anti-depression medication, or pick up a magazine without seeing an ad for one. But what about the very particular ways it hits Black people and shows itself in us? Are we in the grips of an unacknowledged epidemic? I could rattle off our at-risk statistics by heart, but I found myself wondering about something much harder to quantify. How much does...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?